patients are pediatric and they come to me because they have malformations of the body, they have a known genetic syndrome, they have autism, mental retardation, developmental delay, they have something that's unexpected or unusual for the family, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what's the name for it and what's associated with it and how can we best care for that child, as well as what repercussions does this have on the family. Could other children in the future be affected with this? Could the offspring of this child be affected with this? So that's about half the time. About a third of the time I spend doing cancer predisposition testing, and that's something that we're going to do a scenario on today, where we're trying to help people understand what are their risks for cancer in the future. And about 15% of the time I see prenatal or preconception couples who are thinking about having a baby or already pregnant with a baby, and either they know there's something in the family, they know there's something at risk for, the blood test that they had shows they're at risk for something, or the ultrasound that they had of their fetus shows that there's an issue. So I see a broad range of ages and people for different conditions. And, you know, in terms of the Jewish genetic diseases, the two scenarios that we're going to talk about today, one will be cancer predisposition, and one will be like preconception testing for things like TAFE-X. Those are two that I think are worthwhile modeling our consent process on, so that you can help utilize this for understanding your halachic approach to informed consent and for understanding my need as a geneticist to share with Jews what we're all at risk for. So that's a little more of my, you know, disclosures. And I just wanted to take a couple minutes to go over a few salient points that I want you to be thinking of as we're having these conversations, as what we're trying to get through when we do informed consent. So, you know, I wasn't privy to all your conversations that you've had so far, but sort of looking into the geneticist mind in terms of, you know, what we want to, sorry, I have my back to you a little bit, what we want to cover when we meet with a patient. And we usually meet with a patient for about an hour, and there's a lot of talking and a lot of back and forth, and then a lot of paper signing at the end. But essentially, when a person comes to me, the first thing I want to ask them is, you know, why they're coming to me, what do they think they're getting tested for, why would a person get tested for those things, will that change their management of their own medical condition, will that change the management of a pregnancy, what is the purpose of this testing, how will it make life better for that person or their child, and then we talk a little bit about the risks of genetic testing. So, is it that you may feel some stigma in the end if you find out that you have an abnormality in your genes? Is there information that might be revealed to you which was not really why you came to the geneticist? Or the sort of things that we find out by the way that we didn't mean to know? How will this affect you emotionally? Are you a person with anxiety or suicidal ideation that's coming to me for something that's very anxiety-provoking? How is this going to affect you when you get the news? What do you think of blood draws? Some people react very violently to blood draws, so we need to make sure people know that they're getting a blood draw and that you could pass out from a blood draw, you could hit your head on the floor from a blood draw, and those are things that most people know, but we just make sure that people know they're getting a blood draw. Actually, I had one woman come to me the other day, and she was wearing nothing metal, and at the end of the whole consenting process, she said, "What are you going to do to me now?" And I said, "I'm going to send you to the blood drawing lab for a blood draw," and she went, "Oh." She had no idea what she was coming for, but for some reason she had confused in her mind the instructions not to wear metal, which was for a day she was getting an MRI, with coming to the geneticist. So I think she thought she was going to have like some major procedure, and we were just going to draw blood. We also need to make sure that people understand what they are being tested for and what they're not being tested for, that we're not testing people for everything in the world. What are we specifically testing for, and how accurate or how sensitive is that test result. One of the things that almost everybody remembers to ask me is, how much is this going to cost me? And we have to figure that out in terms of insurance and whether things are covered. Does this affect, will I be discriminated against in some way? And we have to cover those topics in terms of insurance or at the workplace. And really, you know, is this something I personally want? So the patient has to, in the medical sphere, we value highly the term autonomy, and I know that that's probably something you've discussed here, but in terms of medical ethics, that's one of the four major things that we value is patient autonomy and making sure that that person is making a choice that's appropriate for them in the context of their lives and what's best for them and their family and their health. And that person has not been coerced to go ahead with the testing, so that you give them a moment to consider what they're doing, and that, you know, you're not just making them sign on the dotted line and move on. So So those are some of the issues that I aim to bring up when I do my counseling, and I just wanted you to sort of have those in mind, you know, to make sure that I've covered them, and if I haven't, to bring up those questions in our counseling session. Okay? Okay. So, should we start with this, that you're coming
sure.
in as a young man?
Okay. Preconception?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll take this as the, so I guess I'm coming in and, you know, I guess, so the way we're playing this out, we're going to go back to my dating years.
Right. So I'm going to introduce myself. So, hi, I'm Dr. Jody Hoffman, and I'm a geneticist, and, you know, you are?
Hi, I'm Robert Clapper.
Okay, and may I ask why you came to us today, how we can help you?
Well, you know, when I was younger, people kept on bringing up Dorya Sharam and that kind of stuff, and it really scared me. I really wasn't into it, but now that I'm dating, you know, it starts wondering, maybe I should find out about some of this stuff. And I know about tape sex, I don't really know about much other stuff.
Okay, so you heard about Dorya Sharam in your schooling, or how did you hear about that?
Heard about it in school, yeah.
Okay, and what was your understanding of the purpose of that program?
Well, so one thing is, I think it was designed to create some kind of anonymous testing mode, and where you'd only find out if you were positive. But the truth is, what it really did for me was it just made me realize how really scary it is, and how people in the community don't really want to know about it. And so before I thought I had the responsibility, I really didn't want it at all.
Okay. And what aspect of that was scary to you?
I think it's, you know, it'd be really scary to know that, you know, that you could try to have a kid, and then all of a sudden you have a kid who's got no chance of living.
Okay. So the scary part was having a baby that might have one of these diseases.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of what Dorya Sharam was doing, where they were trying to find out if you were a carrier, was that part scary, or it was what the results of that would be?
Well, I think I knew realistically that that certainly in my family, that, you know, if we knew that someone else was a carrier, that would have been a major negative. Probably because people think, even if we know it's not scientifically true, that people who have one weakness probably have others.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to go through, once you know that you're a carrier, you have to go through the whole thing, making sure that, you know, then you really have to worry about the other person, and then you raise all the abortion questions, which I'm not sure I'm ready to deal with. So, so it's one of those places where I think I used to think it's better not to know,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm just really not so sure.
Okay. Well, I think it's good that you came to talk about it, because I think that you'll find that by getting this sort of information, you end up empowering yourself to take control of your life and your reproductive future, and making sure that you don't have a baby who's going to have a serious problem and pass away. So a lot of options available to us if you and your partner were found to be a carrier. So let's sort of start at the beginning in terms of what you're at risk for, and then we can talk a little bit more about what the options are. So in general, you know, 1 out of 5 of us of Ashkenazi Jewish descent is a carrier for one of about 17 diseases. The list gets longer every week, so they just discovered the 17th one recently. And essentially, I look at it as good news that we actually know what we as Jews are at risk for. So in a lot of populations, they don't really know what they're at risk for. There's such a mixed population that it's hard to say what someone's at risk for. And as you were saying before, that some people think, well, if you have one mutation, maybe you have others. Well, we all have 6 to 8 mutations somewhere in our genome. So we all have 23,000 genes, and at least 6 to 8 of them have a change. Okay? So it's only when you happen to marry someone who has a change.
What do you mean by a change?
A change.
All of us are different, presumably. There are lots and lots of differences.
Right. So these would be changes. These are abnormalities in a specific gene that, in combination, when passed on from you and your spouse together, could end up making a baby that has problems. So let's sort of talk about the term carrier for a minute. What was your understanding of what a carrier is?
I think a carrier is a person who has, right, who, you know, with a partner with the same genetic change, you know, is likely to lead to some condition which we define as disease.
Right, right. So essentially, we all have 2 copies of every gene, one from our mom and one from our dad. And for generations and generations and generations, there could be a mutation or a change in a gene that's passed on silently. Nobody knows about it because it's not a problem until you happen to marry someone who's a carrier for the same disease. Okay? So for a given disease like Tay-Sachs, did you have any conception of sort of what the chances are that you're a carrier for that?
Not really.
Okay. So for Tay-Sachs, that's one of the higher risk ones. That's about 1 in 25 or 1 in 35 chance. And then there are other genes like mucolipidosis, for which the chance is about 1 in 100. Okay? So if someone finds out they're carried for Tay-Sachs, which is a 1 in 25 chance, then there's a 24 out of 25 chance their spouse is not going to be a carrier, and a 1 out of 25 chance their spouse is going to be a carrier, in which case we need to talk about reproductive options. But if you add up all those different chances together, the chance that any one couple is a carrier for the same condition is about 1 in 100. So just sitting in this room right now, you can feel 99% reassured you're not going to end up with a problem, and 1% chance you are. And it's good to address that 1% because we want to make sure that you could have healthy babies.
Right. Can we just follow this? One in a hundred is the chance that I would meet somebody who has the same genetic predisposition.
Right, before we do any testing, that's sort of the chance, yep.
Okay.
Right. So it's not actually a tremendously high risk, but it's a high enough risk that we want to make sure that we address it. So, you know, I feel like some people can relax a little bit figuring out that, you know, there's really a 99 out of 100 chance that after this testing and your spouse's testing or your future partner's testing, that we're not going to have a problem.
Okay. I presume at some point you'll tell me exactly what the diseases you test are and what the odds are and how many of them are fatal.
Right. So we can talk about the diseases a little bit. So like I said, now we're sort of up to 17, which makes it a little hard to discuss all of them. But I sort of group them into different categories at this point. So there are about 5 of them that are what we call lysosomal storage diseases, where products build up in the body that aren't supposed to be there and usually affect the neurologic system. And those things, because they're building up and building up, get worse and worse and worse over time, and the children usually pass away quite early. So the one that most people know about is Tay-Sachs, and that causes a lot of buildup in the brain and the eyes, and the children lose milestones instead of gaining them. So instead of like learning to sit and walk, they go from sitting or maybe just rolling back to not rolling and not really making eye contact and not hearing and not seeing. And they do tend to pass away before age 10. And so 5 of the diseases are pretty similar to that. Then we have a couple that are cancer predisposition syndromes, and they're very different than the ones that we talk about, that we will talk about later, with breast and ovarian cancer. These are things that affect children before age 10, like leukemia, lymphoma, and gastrointestinal cancers, and they can have cancer after cancer after cancer in the first few years of life, which they can't really survive. Then we have cystic fibrosis, which is something that we share in common with all Caucasians, which causes disease of the lungs, disease of the pancreas, and those people in this day and age can often live until their 30s, but usually are hospitalized quite frequently, sometimes need lung transplantation, so it's not an easy disease. Some of the others affect muscle tone, and because the muscle tone is so low, the children are unable to move their lungs on their own and really can't breathe without a ventilator. And so that's sort of a summary of most of the diseases. The carrier frequency, which means how many people in a how many people will be carriers out of a larger number. So for instance, Tay-Sachs, 1 out of 25 people are a carrier. Something called Canavan, which is similar to that, it's about 1 in 40. Cystic fibrosis, again, is about 1 in 25. And then a lot of the other diseases are a little bit less high carrier rate, so 1 in 80, 1 in 90, 1 in 100 for some of the cancer predisposition genes.
So you're talking about Ashkenazic population.
Right.
So once you have a different mix of family, then that number gets...
Right. So these numbers are really representative of those people who are pretty much sure that they're of Ashkenazi background. And if anyone has members of the family who aren't of Ashkenazi background, that decreases the chance that they're a carrier by some percent.
So what let's just say right now I'm not in a relationship. What happens if I get tested and then it turns out I got with somebody who, for whatever reason, is utterly uninterested in being tested? Right, so was there any gain to being tested? Does it make sense to be tested before I'm in a relationship?
So for some people it does. So for certain people, especially in sort of more modern communities who might date for long periods of time, they often don't get tested ahead of time. They get tested when they're really about to get married, and they sort of say, well, no matter what the results are, it's not going to change whether I marry this person or not. We're going to utilize whatever medical technologies there are. But if you feel like in your life you'd be somewhat limited in the medical technologies, and we can sort of list those in a minute, that only some of them would work for you because of your religious views, then you may want to choose to marry someone who is not the carrier of the same thing that you're a carrier of, because that would present a lot of problems for having a baby. So if you were to meet someone and share with them that, you know, I'm a carrier of cystic fibrosis and it's really important to me to have healthy babies, and that person said, I don't want to be tested, that may really be a reason not to continue a relationship with that person, because that's an important thing to you, not an important thing to that person, and it may be a reason not to proceed with something. But there are, you know, different reproductive options that are medically available, and some are more palatable to people of different backgrounds. You know, one thing that we always offer to couples is adoption, but for people who feel that they need to utilize their own biological material to reproduce, that doesn't work. So adoption is a possibility. Some people will say, well, if we're both carriers of the same disease, really, we can't both pass on our genetic material or there could be a problem. And so just to review our biology, if we're both carriers, so we have one normal gene and one abnormal gene for one partner, and one normal gene and one abnormal gene for the other partner, if you remember your Punnett squares from biology, right, there's a 75% chance with every pregnancy that you'll have a healthy baby. Out of that 75%, 1 out of 3 chance that you'll have 2 normal genes, 2 out of 3 chance that you'll have 1 normal and 1 abnormal gene, which is a carrier healthy person just like the parent, and a 1 out of 4 chance that you'll have an affected child. So some people might say, well, you know, in this pregnancy we're going to use sperm donation and we're going to get the sperm tested ahead of time to make sure that it's not a carrier of this given disease. But for some people they would say, well, I can't really use donated sperm because I'm concerned about the possibility of incest with my child and someone later in life.
So I'm just, you know, what's my incentive for being tested before I'm in a relationship?
Before you're in a relationship? So that maybe you can discuss with your partner whether there is a reproductive technology you would ever utilize together, or whether none are options for you. If none are options for you, you may not choose to pursue a relationship with that person.
But it means it only works if, as a condition of being in a relationship, I require the other party to be tested also.
If you find out you're a carrier of something, yep, and then you ask that person to be tested and you find out they're not a carrier, great, you can proceed with the relationship. And if they are a carrier, you may choose not to be in a relationship.
Yeah. If you know that both you and your partner are carriers of something, are we sufficiently technologically advanced with in vitro fertilization to make sure that we don't implant an embryo that has the disease?
Yep, so that's one of the next options. So we could talk about sperm donation or egg donation, which have some halakhic issues by some standards. For some people who are already pregnant and not necessarily of orthodox background, they might say, well, I'm going to do a CVS or an amnio, which is a testing of the fetal cells at 11 to 12 weeks or at 15 to 16 weeks, and saying, okay, is this fetus just a carrier or not a carrier at all? I'm going to continue the pregnancy, or is the pregnancy affected and I'm going to either get myself very educated about this condition and accept the birth of this child, or may choose to terminate. But the most advanced technology that you're referring to is in vitro fertilization with PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So for many, many people, that is a halakhically viable option, where you essentially take the eggs and the sperm from these carrier people, you put them together in the petri dish, fertilize the eggs, and you've stimulated the woman's ovaries at that point to make lots and lots of eggs so you can make lots of embryos. And at the 8-cell stage, with the teeniest, tiniest glass pipette you can possibly imagine under vacuum pressure, they remove one of those cells from that 8-cell blastocyst, and they look at that one cell. And that one cell can tell us, is that blastocyst one that would go on to be an affected baby, just a carrier, or not a carrier at all? And then we would choose to implant only those blastocysts that are not affected into the womb. So we are technologically there. The success rate of the pregnancy is low, it's about 30%, but the accuracy is very high. So to take an embryo from a petri dish and put it into a womb is a hard thing to do, because sometimes the womb spits it back out, so that's only a 30% chance that it stays, but of choosing the right embryos is a very high chance.
So can I ask, what percentage of serious birth defects is genetically caused?
So about 3% of all children are born with a genetic condition.
3% of all children are born with some kind of, and what percentage of children would you define generally as being born with some kind of condition?
So let's go back. So about 3% of children are born with a congenital birth defect. We can't prove that all of those are genetic, so a smaller percent than that.
We don't know what percent is genetic or not.
Right, because we're not smart enough to know yet, not because they're not necessarily all genetic.
We don't know which ones are genetic and which ones aren't yet.
Right, so some of the things, you know, if a child comes out with a certain group of features, say a very long face, very long fingers, a certain heart defect, we might be able to say, well, that's the 22q syndrome or that's Marfan syndrome. And another child might just come out with short fist fingers and a heart defect, and we say, well, we can't think of which gene that is, but it's probably genetic. So we're not smart enough to know all of that.
So
yet.
Let me frame the question differently. So by taking this testing, so what I do is I put myself in information in a world where everybody tested and on J date they put their testing condition, right? So that would, let's suppose we live in that world. Everyone, so what are the, how much have I reduced my odds of having a child with a serious illness?
So each of these tests has a very high sensitivity. So sensitivity is how likely we are to pick up an abnormality if there is one. So we're only looking for the mutations, the changes in the genes that have been seen in Jews before. So for most of the tests, that's in the 90 to 98% chance range.
Right, that's for the specific disease. But I'm wondering is what percentage of potential diseases does Ashkenazi Jewish testing catch? And even if it gets limited to 99% of those, but those are only 1% of the kind of things that can happen.
Right, so that's an excellent question. I don't think I have the answer to that one.
Okay.
Yeah, don't think I have an answer to that. But essentially, you know, if you find out that you're a carrier of something and your spouse is a carrier of that thing, you know, those are the things we know how to test for in Jews. There are other things that probably affect people across the spectrum that we're not saying they're at a higher risk in Jews, so we don't do any testing for those. So those are probably a much, much lower chance than any of these.
And what's your experience of how it really works socially of Jews who are tested through a standard genetic clinic, fairly Orthodox Jews are tested through a Jewish genetic clinic? Do they actually talk to their potential dates about this early in relationships, or is that real?
Right, so I would have to say that in the Orthodox community, there are probably two options. One is the Dor Yesharim, which is a completely different screening model than we do in the medical setting. So in Dor Yesharim, like you said, people just line up, get their blood drawn, and then when they think about dating one another or they've gone on 3 dates and are thinking of getting engaged, if they're in a super observant community, then you call this number and it says, like, please enter your 6-digit code now, and you put in your code and they're like, please enter the other person's 6-digit code. You know, please give us a callback number. And then a genetic counselor or someone from Dor Yesharim calls and says, you know, good news, you're compatible. And that just means you both had testing for 9 or 11 diseases, whatever they're doing this right now, and you both had tests for those, and you could, one of you could be a carrier for 3 diseases, and one of you a carrier for 7 diseases, but they're, well, I guess 3 and 7, one could be a carrier for 4 diseases, and they're not the same diseases, okay? They're not going to tell you you're a carrier for anything. They're just going to tell you you're not both carriers of the same disease, so you are compatible. Or they're going to say, unfortunately, you are not compatible, and we recommend that you speak to your rabbi. At which point in time, that young couple goes to their rabbi, and the rabbi says, I'm very sorry to tell you this, but we cannot recommend that you continue this relationship. And being that that couple has most likely only dated 3 or 4 times, it's not a big deal to break it off. In the more modern Orthodox community and other groups of Jews, we tend to see that people can get screened maybe during college and find out they're a carrier for something. They date someone for a while, decide that they're very interested in that person, and they have a talk, and that person says, you know, I want to tell you I'm a carrier for familial dysautonomia. And the other person says, oh, well, I was screened and I wasn't a carrier for familial dysautonomia. I was a carrier for Gaucher. And they say, great, we can move on. Or they share the information and they find out, uh-oh, we're both carriers. And then they come and speak to someone like us who says, these are your reproductive options. Are any of these ones that you religiously or ethically would use? And if not, there's adoption. And some of those people, depending on their ilk, will go back and speak to the rabbi. Other people will just make a decision between themselves and utilize the information that way. But I would say that it is difficult information to share at this point because there is not enough momentum behind everyone getting tested. You know, and if everyone was getting tested, it would be very easy and common to say, I'm a carrier of this, I'm a carrier of that. Okay, it was nice meeting you, but it's not going to, you know, this isn't worth our while.
So what percentage of the general Jewish communities by age is tested by age 30?
So that is not a number that's been collected as far as I know. I think that by the time one is 12 weeks pregnant, many people have been tested, but because the only options at 12 weeks gestation when you get your blood test are to terminate, most of us recommend that that's not the best time. I think most educated physicians in America, if they hear Jewish, which they may not have asked at any point, but if they hear Jewish, will recommend screening for at least Tay-Sachs and a couple others, but not necessarily the whole panel. So those are definitely numbers that would be useful, but we don't know them yet. We do know that there's great news in that there's been a 90% reduction in the cases of Tay-Sachs in the Jewish community in the last 20 years.
Do Sephardim have their own set of genetic disorders, or is it just Ashkenazim?
Right, so Sephardi have their own set of disorders. They tend not to be ones that are fatal in the newborn period. Some are the thalassemias, which are like a blood problem where you don't have enough hemoglobin. And those are screened for in almost everybody, again, during pregnancy. But that's probably the most severe thing in Sephardim. And then there's this familial Mediterranean fever, which is like waxing and waning fevers. Again, it's not something fatal. So there's not much of a movement to do Sephardi screening at this point.
You wouldn't even recommend screening for those?
So what we usually recommend is if you have a couple where there's an Ashkenazi person and a Sephardi person, the Ashkenazi person gets screened. And then if that person comes back positive for something, the Sephardi person gets screened for that abnormality, but we don't usually screen for familial Mediterranean fever. We can offer screening for thalassemia. That's very easy.
Just when you mentioned that the doctor usually recommends getting at least screened for Tay-Sachs and a few others versus getting a whole panel, what's the difference in season getting tested only for Tay-Sachs?
The procedure?
Yeah. Do you have to draw more blood? Or is
that it's a little more blood and it's a lot more money. So that's an excellent question. So, you know, the average person that comes to me, before they come, they give me a call and we talk about what their options are, and I would have asked you to contact your insurance company and give you a whole bunch of codes and ask them, do they cover it? In Massachusetts, we're very fortunate in that most companies do cover preconception and prenatal screening. In some states, they only cover prenatal screening, which for most Jews is frustrating because many people do not want to utilize the abortion-only option, and getting screened before pregnancy is much more useful. So many, many companies in Massachusetts will cover it. We're finding in Philadelphia many are covering it, but we haven't investigated all of the states yet.
Okay, prenatal has to be done 12 weeks in, you said?
So prenatal, so most people do not go to their physician's office when they're pregnant before about 8 weeks. And so around 8 weeks to 12 weeks is when people often have their first blood draw, and then it takes 2 weeks to get results back. So it's a very late point at which to be finding out that information.
Let's say you go, you know, on the day you find out you're pregnant, can you do the testing then?
Yes. But again, your only option at that point is termination.
Right.
Or continuation of an effective pregnancy.
Well, I won't talk to Sarah Clappers here, but I believe there's some difference in talking between terminating a pregnancy in the first 40 days and terminating.
Right. The problem is you can't test the fetus before 11 to 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So 40 days gestation is before 11 to 12 weeks, mm-hmm. based on my multiplication of 11 times 7.
Tay-Sachs is like 49. I never got Tay-Sachs below 48 days or something like that, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Sorry. So you could know at that point then that there's a quarter chance that the baby is affected, but you couldn't actually test the fetus.
Right.
I'm just a little bit confused. How is it that we're able to test the embryos for in vitro fertilization, we're not able to test the actual fetus until it's on the way to get to it, right?
Right, so there's no procedure at this point that allows you to go into the womb before 11 to 12 weeks. It may be theoretically possible that if some random person comes and sticks a needle into you and pulls out cells, you can figure it out, but there's a tremendous risk to the fetus of losing the pregnancy, whereas at 11 to 12 weeks, the risk of that needle procedure is about 1 to 2%, and amnio at 15 or 16 weeks is 0.5%, but probably before 11 to 12 weeks would be a really high risk.
So
this might be just because I'm not entirely from the world of screening and not finding out what you have, but why do people do that? Why will they get tested and not want to know for themselves what they carry and what they don't?
Right. So essentially in certain communities, there's a big stigma attached to being a carrier of a disease. People don't necessarily understand what it means to be a carrier, that a carrier is a healthy person, and the only problem is if they marry someone who's a carrier of the same disease. But sometimes if you find out, like, say you found out you were a carrier of Tay-Sachs and lived in an ultra-Orthodox community, then your three sisters might not get married because everyone heard you're a carrier of Tay-Sachs. So in some communities, there's still a stigma. And as a medical doctor, one of the criticisms I have of Dorit Shorim is I feel it perpetuates the stigma, whereas the people in that community feel that is the only way we can do this, so we're doing the best we can, and so I can respect that, but in the communities where there is not a major stigma to being a carrier, it's not a useful technique.
If a baby gets the defective gene from both parents,
mm-hmm.
there's 100% chance they'll develop the disease?
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question? Okay. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to comment that from Israel, a couple from Israel, when we had submission some years ago about being tested, they tell us we don't think.
You're Sephardi?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So there's not a standard recommendation for testing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. The only reason not to test is money?
So the only reason not to test, so one is people's own concern for stigma, and two would be two topics I wanted to bring up, so that's a good thing that you ask. So one of the diseases that I didn't specifically mention so far is Gaucher, which is part of the lysosomal storage disorders. It spells Gaucher, for those of you who don't recognize what I'm saying. But it's now
I've heard it.
That old Gaucher disease. So Gaucher is a late onset lysosomal storage disorder. So essentially, unfortunately, any of us in this room could actually be affected with Gaucher and not know it yet until we started having fatigue, low platelets, low blood counts, bone fractures, bone pain. And so that can occur in someone's, you know, later part of the first decade to into the third or fourth decade. And so when someone like you comes to get screening, I have to tell you that there's a small possibility that you will actually find out that you have Gaucher disease, and that may be something you weren't interested in finding out right now. The benefits of finding out you have Gaucher disease right now is that when you start having bony pain and low platelets, we won't think that you have cancer, and we'll know how to treat you. Because for Gaucher, as opposed to being a universally fatal disorder, there is an enzyme therapy. That enzyme therapy is pretty much unaffordable. It's $200,000 a year, and most people's insurance caps at about $1 to $2 million. So you can get the treatment for 5 or 10 years, and then you have a problem. So it's an IV therapy that you get twice a month over 4 hours at a time, and there's a small possibility we'd find you're affected with that. The other thing that I need to tell you is that there's also an even smaller possibility that we could find out that you have something called late-onset Tay-Sachs, and that is, again, a storage disorder which would cause you to become, in your possibly 30s to 40s, wheelchair-bound and lose mental functioning, and there's absolutely nothing we can do for that disease. So for some people, contemplating the possibility of finding out one of these two diseases is really more than they can bear.
Would there have been a place in a person's life, if they're like the Jewish community particularly, where you would have been tested for this already as a child? Right, it's not something available for even now?
Nope.
So the only way, the only contact you should find out about these things.
Right. So there's something called the newborn screen, where they like prick the baby's heel and they put the little blood drops on a filter paper and send it off to whatever state lab that you're in. And that detects a lot of different things. But the mantra behind newborn screening is to detect things that are for which there are treatments which will change the outcome of the child by detecting it at that time. So to detect something like phenylketonuria, which is a problem where you can't break down one of the amino acids. So you see that on like the Coke, like Diet Coke cans, is like this contains phenylalanine. So that's one of the 20 amino acids, and it builds and builds and builds in the brain and causes mental retardation and poor growth. So So if we can find that out at day four of life, we'll give that child a very different diet and pretty much save their life, okay? But there's nothing we can do for late onset day sacs. And for Gaucher, different diseases are very hard to detect by the tandem mass spec, which is the machine that they use to do this newborn screening, and they're not doing enzyme screening right now, so it's not yet detectable.
What are the odds that you'll tell me that I have late onset day sacs and it's not true?
What are the odds that I'll tell you that you have it's not true? Extremely low, and I can tell you that for Tay-Sachs because when we do Tay-Sachs screening, we do two levels of screening. One is a DNA-based test, which looks at the particular changes that might be in a gene, and one is an enzyme test, which gives us sort of a cutoff of what's a normal amount of enzyme and what's an abnormal amount of enzyme. So we have two ways to look in this case, and the specific mutations will tell us if it's late onset, and the Tay-Sachs enzyme will say there's a problem. So the two things together, I would say probably the risk of a false positive would be 1 in 10,000.
1 in 10,000 of the positives you give, or 1 in 10,000 of test periods?
There would be a 1 in 10,000 chance that you get a positive result that is not correct.
Of all tests?
Of all tests.
And what's
what percentage of the positive tests are incorrect?
What percent of the positive tests are incorrect?
Because presumably late onset Tay-Sachs is very rare in and of itself.
Right. So I don't think I have the number for display for late onset Tay-Sachs. Yeah.
What about Gaucher's?
So it's usually just a DNA technology number. It's not a disease-specific number because the rate is so low. They haven't calculated it for each separate disease.
So just, that means people don't ask this question very often.
Right.
If you don't have a number.
Right. Well, usually you just say 1 in 10,000.
One
in 10,000 is a chance for a DNA test being incorrect.
That's just the general number for DNA test being incorrect right now.
Right.
It tells me absolutely nothing if I don't know what the actual odds of
for false
are.
Positives or false negatives?
So for false positives.
Okay. Great.
Can a person opt not to be told if they have those two things? So if they're genetically tested, be like, listen, I'm getting this for, like, my children, but if it turns out that I'm going to die in 10 years, just don't tell me.
Yes. That'll be perfectly acceptable.
If I don't know the actual frequency of the disease, knowing the percentage of false positives tells me nothing, because I might have more false positives than true positives.
Right. So the actual frequency of any of these diseases. So what you do is you say the carrier rate in one person times the carrier rate in the other person times 1 in 4. So for Tay-Sachs, that's 1 in 25 times 1 in 25 times 1 in 4.
Okay. So what's
1 in 2,500?
What's the carrier rate for adult onset Tay-Sachs?
The carrier rate for adult onset Tay-Sachs is much lower than that. Probably 1 in 30,000 or so, but I have to double check. Someone can look on their computer if they want. But it's the carrier rate or the affected rate.
Okay, so if there's a 1 in 30,000 carrier rate?
No. 1 in 100 carrier rate, which would be a 1 in 40,000.
Yeah, something like
rate.
That.
So
yeah.
So
1 in 40,000 affected rate. 1 in 10,000 false positives is horrible.
1 in 10,000.
That's what I'm trying to get. Is it 1 in 10,000 of the positive tests?
It's 1 in 10,000 of the positive.
Right.
It's 1 in 10,000 of the positive tests.
So you're talking about 1 of...
Not 1 in 10,000 of the tests.
Not in 1 in...
No.
So 1...
That's what I'm trying to get. Is it 1 in 10,000 of the X number of positive tests, 9,999 will be accurate and one is mistaken? Or if you take 10,000 tests, one person will be told that they're positive falsely?
Yeah, I have to double check because now I'm getting myself confused. But it really is a very low chance of missing most of these things, and the chance is not that the test is incorrect so much as the sensitivity is only, say, 95%. So, say, for Canavan's disease, we're looking at, 4 or 7 mutations, depending on which lab is doing it, gives you a little different sensitivity. But if you're looking at 7 mutations, the chance in Jews of finding a change will find the changes that are present in 95% of the people. But some other Jews are going to have mutations in them that came from other parts of the world that weren't necessarily Ashkenazi, and you're missing those. Okay, so there's a sensitivity, and then there's an accuracy.
Right. So a 5% chance that you could be tested and not have something show up that you do have.
Right.
Right.
A false negative. But the chance that you have a false negative and your spouse has a false negative is
one
very
four
low. Is very low. For, and then you have to calculate the carry rate. Yeah. So, I mean, we have not yet had a case where a couple was screened and the results were wrong. We have had cases, unfortunately, in New York where a couple was screened and one came back positive, the doctor didn't follow through with it, or we had a case in which an Orthodox doctor said, why would I screen you? There's no options. And then the person has a retasax, or that an enzyme test was mixed up. I have not heard of cases of live children being born where it was actually a problem with the test results. This is a very
we'll never know if they're a false positive.
Right. The false positive rate is very hard to determine other than by the labs having controls sent to them. And also there's a TASAX, it's called the TASAX, I just forgot the name of the group, but it's from the National TASAX and Allied Disease. They have a TASAX quality control program. So they send out samples to all the TASAX labs and see if, you know, they give a false negative, they give a false positive, you know, if all the enzyme numbers are right. But they probably don't even send out 10,000 samples. So it's very hard to establish these numbers. For the DNA, just the technology alone is the number that they've been calculating.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, how many, on an average year, how many people get tested?
In the country?
Of Ashkenazi Jews in the country, yeah.
We don't know. So we would have to ask every lab that does the testing to reveal those numbers. And they aren't necessarily willing to share those numbers.
Your lab?
So I don't have a lab.
The Victor Center.
Yeah, so between all three Victor Centers, it's probably just in the few thousands over the year. But Dori Shireen probably screens a tremendous amount. And OB offices, you know, hopefully most OBs here are Jewish and do at least a panel four. So if we were to look at, like, just the Genzyme numbers or just the Quest numbers, we'd get a pretty good idea. The numbers that they've given me in the past, they will give me percentage of increase from year to year,
mm-hmm.
but they have not been willing to share what number they're screening per year.
You mentioned that in the case of where you have one Ashkenaz partner and one Sephardi couple partner, that you would test one first and then only test the other for specific mutations. Is there a reason why that wouldn't just be the case always, that you would test one partner first and only if that partner came back with a mutation? Would you consider
We pretty much do that always. We test the woman. If the woman thinks she's 100% Ashkenazi, we test her first. A, because she's definitely going to be the mother of the pregnancy and the man can sometimes change. And B, the woman's insurance is often more willing to pay for preconception screening than men.
I guess, you know, I grew up on the Simpson trial, in some sense. So, some labs are good and some labs are bad, right? And a big source of the error rate in labs is things like confused samples and things like that. Do you have any way of knowing what, other than professional reputation? I guess you say that the TASAX is a quality control center, but all the others, do you have any way of knowing that the labs are reliable?
No, it is just reputation and. You know, the bigger labs that we've worked with for many years, and you never have a problem. You know, you hope to keep working with those kind of labs. Obviously, every lab desires not to make any mistakes, because if they make one mistake, that's the end of the lab. So there are multiple checks and checks on each sample. So, you know, when we send off a blood sample, A, it has your name and date of birth and the date it was drawn. For some of the labs, we have to put on a barcode also, and that barcode matches the requisition, and we often have to put the social security number and the hospital number. So between the name, the date of birth, the hospital number, and the social security number, they have four identifiers to make sure that, you know, we're looking at the right thing.
But David's right that for false positives, there's really no way of checking, because the only way the lab will have a mistake is if it is a false negative.
Right. So false positive.
Would you run the test again if it was positive?
So the lab itself, if they get a positive, they do run it again. So they are checking against their own sample. If they mix the sample, that's not going to help. If the test result was incorrectly abnormal, they should pick it up unless they have a major problem with their technology. Every time they do these tests, they put control positives and control negatives, and if the control positives don't come back positive and the negatives don't come back negative, they have to run the whole run again. So there are lots of checks and balances with how all of these tests are run. So I think that probably the number I was giving you is the false negative, and I don't know the false positive, as you said. Yeah?
So how expensive is all of this
stuff? So that's an excellent question. So I don't know how much it actually costs the company to run these tests. If you were to go through one of the major commercial labs here, and your insurance were being billed, your insurance will be billed approximately $3,000.
For just PACEX or for 17?
For 17 diseases. Okay. If you were to go through a nonprofit lab where you're essentially making a donation to a nonprofit group and they're paying the nonprofit lab for 9 diseases, you could pay $325. And as of September, we hope that a nonprofit lab will be offering 17 for $600. So as the technology changes and they move from sort of DNA-based PCR assays to sort of microarray chip technology, like a computerized technology, I think the cost is going to go down. And I think that really in the next 5 or 10 years, we're all going to have our complete genome on a flash drive, and you'll have your entire sequence of 23,000 genes, and you can plug yours in and your partner's in, and it's going to tell you 40 things that you're at risk for. But right now, this is where we are. So what they bill the insurance company and what the insurance pays has to do with their contract. So they might really only be paying $1,100 or something. I don't know. We're not privy to that. But they're being billed in the $3,000 range.
Are there laws preventing insurance companies from discriminating against me because I have some genetic disorder?
Yes. So in 2008 and 2009, they passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And that essentially had a goal of protecting people from being discriminated by their medical insurance companies. Okay,
so
they
can't say because you're a carrier, this, you know, we're not going to insure your future children.
Right. So you're protected for medical insurance. Your child is protected about their medical insurance. You're protected from workplace discrimination, but you're not protected, and it's not really relevant for carriers, but for other diseases where there's a genetic predisposition, you're not covered for life insurance. So life insurance could discriminate based on your own personal genetic predisposition to something, not that you're just a carrier. Because life insurance is a for-profit enterprise, there's very few ethics involved in that, and you know, if you're going to die sooner, they don't want you're going to pay more.
Health insurance in this country is also a for-profit enterprise.
A lot of the companies are not for-profit.
I forgot Massachusetts, but we're Massachusetts now. The states where most of us are from. Health insurance is still largely for-profit.
Right, but thankfully it's a federal law. So before, 47 out of the 50 states each had state law covering medical insurance discrimination, but in 2008 to 2009 they passed two different parts of the law, and now all the states are covered.
So basically, I want to sign up for my life insurance before I get the genetic testing.
For carrier testing, it really doesn't matter, but for the next scenario, it will matter. Yeah.
So basically, what exists right now are one test for 9 diseases, one for 11, one for 17. And so I was wondering, what happens in a situation where both partners in a relationship tested at different times or with different levels of technology, and one tested for 9 and one tested for 17. Those other 8 diseases, how serious are those, and would that be a reason, if one of the partners was a carrier of one of those other 8 diseases, would that be reason for the one who was?
Right. Always, yeah. So always both partners have to be tested for something that one partner's a carrier for. So if you got tested for 17, you were a carrier of number 16, and she was not she was not tested for that disease, then she absolutely has to be tested. A hand over.
Are there any other risks associated with this that I haven't thought of?
I think we covered most of them. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for most people, obviously it's good in this room to play out all the different scenarios. I think for most people this is a very low risk sort of thing. The unintentional consequences of finding out you're a carrier for late onset Tay-Sachs, I guess, would be the heaviest barrier. Thankfully, in all the screening that the Victor Centers have done in Miami, Philadelphia, and Boston to date, we've never had someone with that disease yet, but it's bound to happen at some point.
Okay.
Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I know that you're saying that, that we're also, that there's more diseases that we're discovering each year, but if we were to know, for example, that our parents did genetic testing and both came back not carriers, I'm assuming, medically speaking, there would be no chance of being a carrier of that disease?
They could only have been screened for Tay-Sachs, anyone in here who has a parent, because that's all they were doing in the 70s or even 80s, really.
Okay.
Anyone in this room, your age parents could not have had genetic testing unless it was very recent and they're still having babies. But, you know, previously in the late 60s, early 70s is when they started doing Tay-Sachs enzyme assays, and the DNA assays didn't come out till a lot later. So, yes, they had one level of Tay-Sachs testing, which is the gold standard, but when one undergoes one of these panels, it's sort of a given that Tay-Sachs is part of it, so there's not really any point in separating it out because it won't cost you any less. It's usually part of a package deal.
Suppose I, last question I think on this, you know, suppose I come in and I say, this is all very interesting, you know, and I have to tell you honestly, I wouldn't do it. It's just that my girlfriend wants it.
Mm-hmm. So did your girlfriend get screening yet?
She did.
And did she find out if she's a carrier?
Sure, she's a carrier.
So which thing is she a carrier for?
I don't know. Pick a...
Canavan.
Canavan, fine.
Okay, so she's a carrier for Canavan. And so what is causing you to feel that you don't want to be screened?
You know, first of all, you know, maybe the relationship will work out, maybe it won't. And, you know, I sort of just think that, I know, you know, God, there are lots of things. I don't know whether I'm gonna, I don't know when I cross the street, whether, you know, whether a car's going to hit me. These are just one, some of the things that, I don't know that we need to know everything. It just makes me uncomfortable. You know, I would do it for her, but it's not really what I want to do.
Right. So I guess then it's important for you and her to be talking about, you know, what your expectations are for babies and whether the two of you together will be willing to bring a baby into the world affected with Canavan and how that would affect your relationship. If that's something that she absolutely couldn't handle, either, or you couldn't handle, then either, you know, you need to find out what your carrier status is, or you need to not be necessarily pursuing.
Well, but we've talked about it, and she's not willing to go ahead, so I'm willing to do it. I just feel like I need to tell you that it's not really what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just doing it because it's the only way she's going to continue the relationship.
Okay. So it sounds like you're feeling sort of forced into this, and I'm glad that you're sharing that. I think we need to think a little bit more about, you know, play out all the different scenarios here. So say you didn't do the testing, what would happen when you go back today to her?
She'll probably tell me that, you know, perhaps we'll see each other in some other life.
Mm-hmm. So that would sort of end your relationship?
Yeah.
And would that be a big loss to you, or you're sort of iffy about things?
I think it is. Right now, I think, you know, look, we're not engaged, but you know, it's pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be sad, sure.
Mm-hmm. And if
that's why I'm willing to go along, otherwise I wouldn't be willing to go along
right.
with it.
So if you did go through with the testing and you came back that it was normal, how would you feel?
I guess I feel relieved.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right now, without having tested you, it's about 39 out of 40 chance that you would come back normal. So that would be very reassuring, and you'd be able to continue in your relationship and, you know, hope to have healthy babies together. And then if it came back abnormal, which is about 1 in 40 chance, how do you think that would affect things?
I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know how we would. That's why I'm not so sure. You know, that's why for myself, I think that, you know, maybe a 1 in 40 chance is something that we can deal with because there are lots of things. You know, we live in a country where the chance of divorce is higher than that,
mm-hmm.
a lot higher than that. I deal with lots of statistical risks. And I don't know that I would, you know, if I walked into a marriage therapist and they tell me, look, you know what, you're passive aggressive, that raises the risk of divorce by 10%. Do I want to know that? Not really. Nothing I can do about it. It's always going to be something.
Right. So I guess the other thing is to consider if you sort of do nothing and she does continue to stay with you and then you had a baby together that was affected, you know, how that would affect you also.
So now, can I, I'm going to step out of the scenario for a moment?
Yes.
So now, do you need to have this conversation with me because you can't go ahead if I tell you explicitly I'm only signing because of the girlfriend pressure?
It's not a can't. It just, you never want to have someone go ahead with a test that they're not sure they want and is not urgent. So we could, at this point, I could give you a pamphlet of information about Canavans and say, I want you to think about what it would be like to have a baby with this and whether you're willing to take that risk and talk to your girlfriend again and then come back. If this was something very urgent and you said, you know, you were only doing it because someone else wanted to do it, it might be a little bit different thought process, but it's not urgent.
So let's change the scenario. So she's already pregnant.
She's already pregnant.
And she's been, and she knows she's a taste sex carrier, and I've always refused.
Okay. And so if you were to find out that you were a taste sex carrier, you know, have the two of you discussed whether you would ever end a pregnancy or not?
We can't deal with it.
You can't deal with it? You mean you can't deal with the thought? Or
can't even deal with the thought.
You can't deal with the thought. Okay, so, you know, as a doctor, then I would share with you that I have found that for people who do confront the possibility of their baby's affected and test the baby and make an active decision whether to continue or end the pregnancy, the outcome will be much better for the family. So if a family who's maybe, you know, has no religious compunctions or, you know, objections to terminating, they might terminate. But for the other family who says, I would never terminate, there'd be 75%, if you were a carrier, there'd be a 75% chance that that baby's not affected and you can breathe deeply and move on. And if the baby was a carrier, then we spend some time making sure that that couple gets the therapy that they need to adjust to having a baby with a serious medical illness and what it's going to be like to have that baby. So there's very well-studied literature on Down syndrome in terms of if someone finds out ahead of time that they're able to make that mental adjustment and accept the birth of a child with a chronic illness or even a fatal illness, whereas if you just give birth and out pops a baby with Down syndrome, that family has a much harder time accepting that baby because it is not the baby they expected. So to change your expectations to expect a child with chronic disease sometimes really helps people adjust to, you know, loving that baby for who that baby is and finding the social network and the family support to help deal with it.
So let's suppose, right, you've done all this. At the end of it, I still say to you, you know what, Dr. Hoffman, I appreciate that, but I still got to tell you, my wife weren't insisting on it, I would never do this.
But you're willing to do it.
But I'm willing to do it. For her.
Okay, and so then I would probably ask you again about what you will do to yourself if you come back positive. How will you react? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. You know, it might increase my stress level tremendously.
Would you and your wife would you and your wife allow an invasive procedure or you would not?
You know, again, you know, if you ask what we're like generally, we're bad at dealing with things until they happen. I like not knowing stuff, you know, and dealing with that as it happens. She likes knowing as much as possible in advance. You know, it's part of what a marriage is. Sometimes you do things you really don't want to do for the sake of your spouse.
Right, and so, you know, in that case, if you are presenting yourself to me in this clinic without someone dragging you in by handcuffs, which does happen for certain diseases, and often surprise the 50% of pediatric patients that are in the waiting room going, Daddy, why is he in shackles? But if you came in on your own volition and you're presenting yourself in front of me and saying you're willing to get the test but that you don't really want to get it, you know, I have to sort of make a judgment call at some point. There's no medical halakha per se that says, or ethos that says, like, you can't do the person if they're wishy-washy about it. If they've been informed of all of the information and they're still willing to go ahead with it, then sometimes based on the family dynamics, we will, and other times if it seems like it's going to cause a major rift, we won't. But, you know, if someone's heard all the information, they're still saying that they're a little wishy-washy about it, and there's time involved, and they're still willing to go ahead with the test, you know, Sometimes we do.
Interesting. Okay, we should probably go on to the other case, then we can push that.
Okay, so completely switching gears now, and I guess if any of you still have questions about this one, we could always try to catch them at the end, but let's switch gears a little bit. So again, you're coming to me, and I'm asking you, you know, can I ask what brought you in today?
In order to not interrupt the flow, I wanted to ask, and this also relates to what you're about to do, this first set of questions that you do, at, let's call it the intake phase.
Yes.
For you as a doctor, what does that accomplish?
First of all, a lot of people have no clue why they came in, and they're annoyed. So you're establishing, first of all, whether they want to be there or a doctor sent them or their wife sent them or their daughter sent them. So do they want to be there? Are they willing to be there? Are they there because they have to be? Do they know why they're there? Do they know what we're about to talk about? And so I start at different levels of information depending on how the person presents themselves. So if they say right at the beginning, like, I'm coming to be screened for 17 Jewish genetic diseases. I saw your presentation at Hadassah, and I'm ready to go. Or, you know, like he's saying here, you know, my wife is making me do this. You know, there's sort of different ways that we'll end up communicating and different levels of information that need to be addressed.
I guess I qualify as asking, like, what if I just tell you up front, like, numbers mean nothing to me? So I can't really assess all what you're saying about risks. You know, all I can say is, you know what, I think this program exists. You know, I knew Mrs. Victor. And she seemed like a nice lady. She wouldn't set up a program if it wasn't worthwhile. Is that kind of right? Is that
right? So I guess, you know, at that point, I feel like I have to make sure that person understands that they might find out stuff they don't want to understand. And other than that, I don't really care if they understand the numbers or not. They know that this is a good thing to do, and I need to make sure they know what risks there are. They don't need to know the benefits as much. You know, you need to know that there's some possibility that if you have an abnormality, that there's something we can do about it. But, you know, there are suggestions as to what informed consent is. Even if you sign a piece of paper with all of the levels of informed consent, it will not hold up in a court of law if the person says, I didn't really understand or I didn't mean to sign it. And, you know, this brings up an interesting article that I just read, written by the people in the UK, called "Request for Treatment" as opposed to informed consent. And request for treatment, the person has to actually write out the consent form themselves. So it says, like, you know, what are you being tested for? And the person has to write in what they're being tested for. Why are you being tested for it? What are the risks of being tested? So that you know that it's coming from their brain, that they have put on a piece of paper what they're being tested for is why, and then you read it over. If there are any disagreements as to what the patient said and what you were trying to convey, there's a part to, like, straighten that out, and then the person signs after that. So that's kind of a new movement that seems to be coming in request for treatment as opposed to informed consent, because request for treatment really makes the person identify what's going on rather than just signing below the dotted line.
Okay. So we can
the person gets it wrong in the request for treatment.
Right. So then there's this portion that you have to rectify. And if they had everything wrong, you have to go back a step and re-educate.
Okay. So let's take the other scenario. I'm walking in. I'm here for some kind of cancer susceptibility screening because I have my own diagnosis, and everyone in my family just coming down on me and saying, you gotta do this, we gotta know what's going on with the kids. I hate it.
You hate which part? That they're telling you?
Yeah. Bad enough to deal with my own diagnosis, have to deal with kids just way too much.
Wow. So are you currently affected with cancer?
So I'm told.
So you're told, and which kind of cancer is that?
I think we said breast cancer, right?
Yeah.
No, I still get it. Male breast cancer still gets to me. Yeah.
Okay. So you were diagnosed with breast cancer, and about how long ago did you get that diagnosis?
6 months.
6 months ago. So did you have any surgery already, or no, chemo or radiation?
Chemo.
And have you finished your course of chemo, or are you still in the midst of that?
Still in the midst.
And so when was your last chemo session?
Last week.
And how are you feeling today?
Awful.
Yeah. What's bothering you?
Blah. Generally blah. Lots of feeling in some of the fingers.
Yeah, that's really, really difficult time to be doing something like thinking about heavy information when you're already taking care of yourself, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like you feel like there's sort of a family obligation to this whole coming in today.
I don't know if I feel the family obligation. A lot of family pressure.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. And have you, you know, I think that part of what we're going to do today is try to talk about, you know, why people would recommend that you come in here and sort of what the benefits would be for doing any testing, and then we can talk about at the end if you think you're ready to go ahead with that testing or really need some time to think about that. Okay. So I read in your records that you were Ashkenazi Jewish, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so as far as you know, all of your family members have been Jewish.
Or as I know.
Yeah, like Eastern European. Okay. And do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Yeah, how many do you have?
I have a sister.
You have a sister? And has she had any kind of cancer?
Actually, sorry. In this case, I have three. Sorry, I gotta put it all right. It's supposed to be in my part of my wife's family here.
Different family.
Yeah, I gotta think of that. I have three sisters.
You have three sisters, and have any of them had cancer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which kind of cancer?
Ovarian.
Ovarian. Okay. And how old was your sister when she had ovarian cancer?
30s.
Is she still living?
Yeah.
Okay. So she survived that.
Yeah.
That's very fortunate. Did she go through any sort of genetic testing that you know of?
I think so, yeah.
You think so? And did she find out if she had any mutations or changes in her genes?
I think she had one of the BRCA or something that they call it.
A BRCA mutation?
Yeah.
Okay. So I can see how this has been sort of brought up in your family before, and they're thinking maybe now since you have breast cancer that could be related somehow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you have any other ongoing medical issues that we should know about?
Not me.
No? Do you have any daily medications you take other than things for the breast cancer?
No.
No? And are you still working these days?
Yep.
Okay. So you're able to make it through the work day. Do you take a little time off with each chemo session? Or?
Nah, I work through.
You've been, okay. What kind of work do you do?
I teach.
You teach. Okay. And you have children, you mentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many children do you have?
Four.
Four children? And what's the age range of the kids?
3 to 12.
3 to 12. And is the oldest one female or male?
Female.
Female, okay. And how are your kids all doing?
You got already? Kids, I think are doing okay. You know, it's hard. It's hard, you know, but it's easier dealing with healthy parents.
Yeah, so they've been having a hard time missing dad and his near regular active life, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been hard. Do they have health issues, though, going on?
Nope.
No, it's just a sort of dealing with dad being sick, yeah. Okay. And your other two sisters that didn't have ovarian cancer, they've had no cancers?
Not that we know.
Okay. And how about your mother? Any cancer to her?
Many kinds.
What kind does she have?
Ooh, I lost track even. Breast, bone, possibly some others.
Pancreatic or?
Not that I know.
No. And melanoma?
Not that I know.
Or lymphoma? Okay. And your mom, did she have brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
How many did she have?
She has only one sister.
I'm
not out of this family. One sister.
One sister. And any cancer to her?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And how about your aunt's children? Any cancers to them?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And your mother's parents, did they have any cancer?
Yes.
What kind of cancer?
Breast cancer.
And that was in the your grandmother or grandfather?
Grandmother.
Okay, and do you know about how old she was with that?
No.
No. And your mother was about how old when she got her breast cancer?
Don't know, very late diagnosis.
So it was a very late diagnosis. Did she pass away with that?
Nope.
No? So when she was diagnosed, do you know about how old she was? Like 40s, 50s, 60s?
50s.
50s? Okay. But they thought it was pretty far advanced
at
that point. It had spread to her bones. Okay. And do we know of anyone else in your mother's side of the family that had breast cancer?
I think that there's a record of great aunts also, but I'm not sure.
Okay. And how about ovarian cancer?
I don't know.
Okay. Prostate cancer?
None of the women, no.
None of the women?
We joke about this, because actually my sister-in-law once got a return from her medical records, right, stating that her tests had shown that she didn't have prostate cancer.
Oh, that's good. Well, it would have been more appropriate that she didn't have a prostate.
It's better. It's better to get a false negative than a false positive.
Okay.
It's part of I also have gotten recently medical records that assured me that I was fine despite this medication, which I'd never been on. So I'm a little nervous about this medical record thing.
Okay. And then your dad, any cancer to him?
No.
Okay. And does he have siblings?
Yeah.
Any cancer to them?
No.
And how about your cousins on that side? No.
Not good at knowing this.
Okay. And your dad's parents, any cancer to them?
Don't know that either.
Okay. And were they also of Ashkenazi descent or no?
As far as I know.
Okay. Okay. So, so at this point I'd like to teach you a little bit about cancer genetics so you understand sort of, you know, why someone would be here, what we're thinking about, and how this would apply to you. So essentially, out of all the cancers that we see, about 90% are just by chance, but about 10% are hereditary. And so when we see a family like yours where you had a personal history of breast cancer, your mother, your grandmother, and your sister had ovarian cancer, we have to say, well, is it possible that there's something hereditary going on here? Because it seems a little too coincidental that so many people in the same family are getting cancers, okay? So when we think about cancers, there are two different ways we can get cancer. One is the by chance cancer, and one is the hereditary cancer. So in the by chance cancer, we inherit a gene from mom and a gene from dad that both tell our cells, don't overgrow, don't overgrow, don't overgrow. So for every breast cell, for every ovarian cell in a woman, for every prostate cell, those genes are constantly telling that cell, don't overgrow, don't replicate more than you're supposed to. But sometimes we get mutations or changes in those genes from things like fertilizers, radiation, smoking, oxidants, all sorts of things. They're constantly sort of hitting us in different places in our bodies, doing little pieces of damage to our cells. And within each of those cells are the genes, and if one of those genes is damaged, that's okay, because we still have the good copy from the other parent telling that cell, don't replicate, don't replicate, don't replicate, okay? But, you know, maybe if someone has damage to one breast cell at age, you know, 54, and then they get a second point of damage in the same cell at age 72, that cell starts to grow out of control and makes a tumor, okay? So when we see a family where, you know, somebody had breast cancer at 83 and someone else had prostate cancer at 74, we say, well, you know, that's sad, but if we all live long enough, we'd all end up with cancer of some sort. So as the years go on, we accumulate little nicks in our DNA and they add up and they can cause cancer in the long term. But when we see someone of your age or of your sister's age who was only 30 when she got ovarian cancer, we have to say, well, is it possible that you were both born with one normal copy of the gene from your dad, but one abnormal copy of the gene from your mom? And all it took was one nick to one gene in one breast cell to let that cell start growing out of control and become a tumor. Or in your sister, one nick to one gene in one ovary cell to start growing out of control and become ovarian cancer. Okay? So it's sort of the same process ends up in cancer, but the people that have the hereditary risk already have one point of damage in every single cell, and it just takes one point of damage in the other gene to cause that cell to start growing out of control. So that's a pretty important point. Did that make sense to you?
Sure. That was actually
good. Okay. Anyone out here with a question? Yes.
Can you have predisposition at both genes nicked?
Can you be born with both genes nicked?
Yes.
So that's a great question. And we think no, you will not have... You can't have both copies of the same gene abnormal, or else you do not seem to survive embryologically. So if BRCA1 has mutations in both copies, you will die in utero. Yep.
What are we gaining from testing him after he already has cancer? Wouldn't it make more sense to test the kids at this point?
So that's a good question. So we'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay, but I just want to make sure people understand, like, how the cancer happens genetically. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter if it would be a breast cell or uterine cell or prostate cell. It's just wherever it happens to break down, or is someone's predisposed to breast cancer.
Okay, so that's really important. So what we're talking about here, having two copies of the same gene, that would be a specific gene. So the genes that we're talking about right now are the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. So it's breast cancer 1 and breast cancer 2, okay? So those are genes that protect our breast cells from overgrowing, but also protect ovarian cells, also protect prostate cells, pancreatic, skin cells, lymphoma, and occasionally colon. So those are the cells that we know are regulated by the BRCA1 and 2 genes, but there are other genes that regulate a combination of colon, uterine, ovarian, stomach, bile duct. So there's sort of different genes for different regions of the body. Some of them overlap. But the genes that are relevant in this case, where you have an Ashkenazi Jewish family, where we're seeing breast and ovarian cancer, would be BRCA 1 and 2. Okay? So, so essentially, now that we understand that there's a possibility of a hereditary predisposition, and we look at your family, we have to say, well, given the Jewish background and the multiple cases of breast cancer and one case of ovarian cancer, that I'm concerned that you may actually have one of these inherited genes. And there are several different reasons why it's important to know if you have one of these genes. So one is, if you actually have one of these genes, you may need extra screening in the future because you may be predisposed to another episode of cancer. And although that's very scary to face, as you know, with the case of your mother who had very far progressed cancer, it's important to catch cancer at the earliest stage possible. So just because you had breast cancer in one breast does not mean it's not possible to get it in the other breast or even a second time in the first breast. So we need to increase the screening for you if you do in fact have one of these genes. We would also want to increase the screening frequency for prostate cancer because we know that instead of being sort of a low to moderate risk in the general population, it will be a moderate to high risk in you. So we will want to check your prostate more frequently. We'd want to make sure you're getting your colonoscopies. So there are things that we would do for you that would improve, hopefully decrease the chance of having a far progressed cancer as life went on. And then the other thing that I think is really important and why your family was probably pushing you is that knowing about the hereditary cancer genes is sort of a family affair. So essentially, as I mentioned, if your mother was the one who had this abnormal gene, she had a 50-50 chance of passing it on to each child. So it sounds like your sister had some testing done and she had an abnormality found. So it sounds like your mother probably had a change in her gene. She passed it on to your sister. And given that you have breast cancer and that male breast cancer is an unusual cancer for men, we have to assume that there's a high chance that you also inherited that gene. And then your two sisters may possibly have also inherited that gene. Do you know if your two sisters got tested yet?
They're probably under the same pressure.
Yeah, but you're not sure if they went for testing yet. Okay. You know, and everything comes in time, and people have different times when they're ready to address this kind of information, but I think it's good you came in. You know, one of the things that a lot of people say, well, what's this going to do for my, you know, 5-year-old or 7-year-old or 12-year-old right now? And the truth is, really right now, it's not going to do much for them at all. And that's because even with this inherited risk for cancer, we don't expect to see any cancers whatsoever until about the mid-20s, okay? So if you have children who are 12 and under, the testing for you right now, in terms of their sake, is not so important, but for your own health care may be important because they may step it up a notch. So instead of doing mammography on a woman, they may do MRIs. And instead, for someone who's had breast cancer, instead of doing ultrasound, they may do MRI. Or they may do a different sort of evaluation on you, which would pick up things earlier and keep you healthier longer.
I have two questions. One is, you're randomly reading the newspapers, it sounds like a lot of the advanced screening that people have proposed over the last 10 years turned out not to have long-term survival benefits at all, and just subjected people to lots of scary and annoying tests.
So you're talking about the change in the mammography recommendation?
And the prostate cancer recommendation.
Okay. So for the general population, that's definitely true. But for people in the high-risk population, meaning they know they have a hereditary gene, we do know that screening improves long-term survival. Because we know that by having that gene, you're at very high risk for the cancer. So it's really important to screen for it, whereas in the general population, there's not such a high risk, so all the side effects of the testing may outweigh the benefit.
I don't know, but it just sort of shook my faith in this whole, because I'm sure that if I had walked in 2 years ago, I would have been told the same thing about early mammography, that we know that early detection saves lives. And right now, you know, it sounds to me like people have done lots and lots of tests, particularly people seem to have confused progression-free interval for survival. And so I'm just like, right now, like, I don't like this kind of information. And I just don't have faith that this works at all, because it turns like most of these things, you'd have to have data over a really long time, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really have data over a really long time, because we've just put in the increased screening protocols and things like that, so you couldn't really know.
Well, essentially they look at people of all different ages and add up sort of what they would expect over X number of years, and they are able to show that people with high risk for cancers, like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, do fare better if things are detected earlier. So as a man, you don't have ovaries, as we just mentioned, but for women to find out they have ovary cancer at a very early stage tremendously increases the survival, because if ovarian cancer is found when someone is already symptomatic, so they come to their doctor saying, I feel very full down here, my legs are kind of swollen, I'm not feeling well, there's very little chance of their survival. But if, for instance, they say, you know what, I'm 35, I've had my 4 kids, I know I have this gene, I know that in my lifetime I have a 25 to 44% chance of ovarian cancer, I'm going to get my ovaries out, the chance that that person is going to survive now is greatly increased, because their risk of ovarian cancer goes from what we just said to a very small percentage. So it reduces the risk by 98%. So for women, there are absolutely things that we can do. We can remove organs, which will reduce the risk substantially. So that's not really screening, that's a prophylactic measure. So removing the ovaries. Some women will actually remove their breast tissue, and that reduces their risk of breast cancer by 90%. And we say 90% and not 100% because there's no fine line between the chest wall and the breast tissue to really say where.
I'm sort of confused by how removing ovarian cancer only reduces your removing your ovaries only reduces your risk of ovarian cancer by 98%.
Right. So the cells that line the space where the ovaries were sitting are also of the same origins as the ovaries. So you can sort of get cancer of the lining, which is they're called epithelial cells from the ovary, but they're not of the organ of the ovary. They're related. So it still would be ovarian derived tissue, but it's not from the actual ovary.
So do we know that they don't just develop the cancer somewhere else to compensate?
So that is not a theory that has been out there. Essentially you get a mutation at a specific place, and that's where the cancer starts going. So if you don't have the ovaries, you can't get the mutations in the ovaries.
And is there any data specifically for men?
For some men who do have more breast tissue, there have been debulking surgeries where they remove some of the breast tissue. But the male population of breast cancer is very small, and I think there is much less outcome data for the men than there is the women. But you said that you do have 2 daughters, right? Right. So right now, when they're quite young, this information is not as important for them. But as they become 21, 25, this is the kind of information that would be helpful to them. So right now, looking at your family without you even going through any testing, we could make a pretty safe assumption that one of your genes is actually damaged. So your sister has an abnormal gene. You had a 50-50 chance, if you had never had breast cancer, of having that gene. But now that you've had the breast cancer, it's a very high chance that you're going to be also a carrier of that gene. And then each of your children has a 50-50 chance.
So what would be the purpose of my being tested as opposed to waiting till they grow up and having them be tested?
In your case, I would say that it would sort of be confirmatory, and it would help your doctors realize for sure that this was from the BRCA gene and not from something else. You know, if you had worked in a high radiation area or you worked with some chemicals, that it was from that. And it may help direct sort of how long they give the chemo or what types of chemo or follow-up medication, so there's some hormonally sensitive tumors, they may change their management in some way. But if your doctors say they wouldn't make any changes based on it, then you're correct that probably at this point in time, we can just make an assumption and your kids could be tested for the family mutation when they're in their 20s, and you wouldn't necessarily have to have that blood test.
Okay.
To interject here, it seems like you've basically, through these questions, done the test without doing the test. And in terms of informed consent, I feel like some border might have already been crossed at this point.
Right. So essentially when this is an interesting area. So in the UK, so here in America, if someone has a mutation and you think that their, you know, twin sister is at risk, or you're allowed to inform them if their sibling will not inform them because they are at high risk for something, and the ethos in the UK is that it's more important to to inform that sibling and make sure they get tested properly than to keep the confidence of this person. Here you're correct that this is a family affair. So his sister getting tested essentially gave everyone else a 50-50 risk of having this mutation. His breast cancer told me he has this mutation.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty much, you know, 99.9%.
But he didn't know that yet.
He didn't know that yet, but I think that he is telling me that his sister had it and that his mother had it. So he sort of probably grew up in a way realizing I'm at high risk. And that's something we all come to realize over time. And then when you get the cancer, you say, oh, I was at high risk, and in fact I got it, and there's something in the family, and people start to make these connections. So you're not really telling them something they didn't know already. Usually they understand this to a certain degree on their own, that it's a family thing, and he knows his sister was tested. So she was probably informed to go home and tell the other siblings, I have some bad news. I have this BRCA mutation, and it means you're at 50% risk, and I really want you to get yourself taken care of so that you don't end up like with, you know, like I did with ovarian cancer. So patients end up having to inform their siblings of this kind of information, and then you hope that those people go and speak to someone that knows more information.
So it's kind of almost like, in some ways, kind of like the neighbor, since he already has all the information together that he could piece together that he is a carrier, that you haven't really told him anything by saying that he's a carrier.
Right. I've probably put all the pieces together, but I think, you know, if you had asked him directly at the beginning, you know, what is your understanding as to whether you're a carrier or not, most people do come in realizing that, is it like, I think I'm probably a carrier. Like, you know, the two sisters, on the other hand, for them it's really a 50-50 thing, and it's even more anxiety provoking because they have no idea. You know, it's really a flip of the coin. For him, he comes in already affected with breast cancer. He knows. So there's a very different counseling session for the pre-symptomatic people, the people that don't have any signs of cancer, and the people with cancer in the family and have the cancer.
This is a broader philosophical question that I'm not sure you can necessarily answer, but we'll try anyway. I'm really conflicted about just thinking about this and to the extent of how much power we have over this and the decision making that we're given. And I guess I can understand, you know, we're talking about something like TSAC, you know, where there's this really, you can get a really high chance of it, it's really traumatic. But, you know, kind of combining the last scenario and this scenario, like, so basically my husband's family has the BRCA mutation. They recently found out his mother has it, and then her twin sister has it, and so, as I understand it, none of the kids need to get tested yet, because in their family it starts like about 50 or so, and so they don't really have to get tested until, like, this is what I understand, I don't know if this is wrong or not, but they're all in their 20s, and so none of the doctors seem to be concerned just yet. But, and both of them did have the really extreme double mastectomy and hysterectomy, because they decided they'd already had all of their kids and things like that. And so, but I wonder though, to the extent of like, should I be thinking about this, like, should my husband get tested before we have kids? Because this is something that I'd rather not put my kids through, but like, I mean, it's just such a difficult situation to be in, because like, to think that when my kids are 50, they might have to go through this, which of course you want to protect your kids from everything, but to what extent? Because
it's definitely, it's a very difficult thing to think about in terms of kids. Because A, it's something that's late onset as opposed to TSAC, like you said, which is infantile onset. That child has no hope. There's nothing in the next 4 to 5 years we're going to do to cure that kid before they pass away. Whereas cancer, I would say that they did a survey of all of the labs across the country that do any cancer predisposition testing, and only 3% of them have ended up having requests for prenatal testing, so for like PGD or for doing a CVS or an amnio to make a reproductive decision. So I think very few people utilize this information in terms of making a reproductive decision.
But they could tell if their fetus has the mutation?
They could. Many geneticists will resist doing that testing. And that's because the chance of breast cancer in one's lifetime is about 12%. The chance of breast cancer with hereditary predisposition is more like in the 60 to 80% range. It's a big difference, but 12% is still a high risk. And there are so many things that we're learning to do for cancer every day and week that to say, well, someone 30 years from now might get breast cancer, I'm not going to bring them into the world. If you ask most people with a BRCA mutation, are they glad they're in the world, or would they, do they think that the cancer was such a debilitating thing they would not have wanted to come into the world? You're not going to find many people who said they think this was so horrible that they wouldn't come into the world, unless, like, maybe that was the day they got their diagnosis. But a year out from diagnosis, you're not going to get that. Whereas I think the vast majority of parents with a child with Tay-Sachs, and that child with Tay-Sachs cannot speak for themselves ever, will feel that no matter how much they love their child, it was a very difficult thing for the child, and that the child suffered, and the child did not enjoy their lives, and the parents suffered, and that overall, besides those moments of hope that we all glean from every child with special needs, that was a majorly difficult thing. So most people do not make reproductive decisions, but we, you know, and I don't want to be giving you medical information that's contradictory to what anyone else told your family. In general, and I don't know your family's situation, we do say that by age 25, because that's when the screening technologies are supposed to begin, that someone should know at age 25 or so if they are a carrier of one of these genes. Okay, because then we would do the increased breast cancer screening, which usually does not come on now until 40 to 50. We would do the ovarian screening, and we would recommend that those women think about having babies before their late 30s, at which point in time the ovarian risk is getting greater and greater and greater, and we would remove the ovaries. So there are two very different areas to consider, and a lot of it has to do with quality of life. Other thoughts?
That's a hard one. I feel like prophylactic surgery, I have to say, that's such a scary notion. To remove organs because of a physical risk that has no, you know, that hasn't developed at all. I mean, dealt with it. It's a really scary thing.
It is. It's a very scary thing, and I think for most women who get this diagnosis, they have their children. You know, there aren't that many women that I think come to us by age 35 figuring out that all this is going on, but, you know, if they do come to us age 35, 38, we say at that point to start thinking about removing the ovaries. A lot of times we have women who come to us that are already, you know, 54, 62, they've already gone through menopause, they have no use for the ovaries whatsoever, and it's not a big deal to them at all to remove their ovaries. In the scheme of surgeries, it's a very small surgery. If you just remove the ovaries and fallopian tubes, if you remove the uterus, it's a much bigger surgery, but for women who are premenopausal and know what the changes of menopause are, or know that there's still the small possibility they might possibly consider having a child, it's a huge decision to make in terms of removing the ovaries, but the vast majority do proceed with that. I would say a very small percent proceed with the prophylactic breast surgery, because I think that most women view their breasts as a much more essential visible part of the body, whereas ovaries are, you know, after a certain point, not useful and not visible.
And do you see a role in these conversations? Like, what are you trying to accomplish in these conversations? Like, it sounds to me like a genetic testing conversation. I've heard your other procedures that you're an advocate, and your goal is to get to consent in large measure. What, right, is that fair? And in these conversations, do you also have a goal you want to get to?
That's fair. I mean, most of the people who are coming to me really deserve the testing and need to have it. But there are other people who it's a very difficult conversation with, saying, you know, I saw on the news that, you know, women can get tested for a gene for breast cancer, and I had a grandmother who had breast cancer at 89, and I want to get tested. And then you have to spend the whole time explaining why you shouldn't get tested, that this is, you know, this is a test meant for high-risk people. This is a $3,000 test. Your insurance will not pay for this test. Just happens to be $3,000, like, but it's like $3,450, and that there's really no utility without a strong family history. So, say for instance, we get into also a very difficult situation. Say for instance, your sister, she with the one with ovarian cancer, she first was tested for the three Jewish mutations. So there are three mutations that make up 95% of all the mutations seen in Ashkenazi Jews in BRCA 1 and 2. That's a $565 test. Much cheaper, you know, but gives us a very high yield. So she did that test. Then it came back normal. And she went back to the doctor and they said, wow, you know, that's kind of suspicious because, you know, you had ovarian cancer at 30, which is extremely unusual, and your mother had breast cancer and your grandmother had breast cancer. There must be a mutation somewhere else in the gene. So let's go ahead with the whole gene sequencing. Well, that came back normal. Now what? Now we're in a real bind because we have no idea what your two other sisters' risk is. We have nothing we can use to test them. They are part of the group of people in our society who don't have a BRCA1 mutation, don't have a BRCA2 mutation, and are part of the 16% of the pie where we're just not smart enough to know where the mutation is in the genome, and until we do that complete sequencing of the genome, we're not going to know. So for most people, they are very pleased to know what the cause in the family is and to be tested for it. But we run into very difficult situations with families where it's clearly generation after generation of breast and or ovarian cancer, and we're not smart enough to find the change in that gene. And then for those people, I mean, I don't usually do the end-term counseling in terms of what organs to remove. I sort of say these are the options, and you'll go to the breast care specialist and they'll discuss it with you. But it's very hard for the breast care specialist at that point to say, you have five generations of bilateral breast cancer, but you're negative for the gene. We could remove your breast, but maybe there's a 50% chance you didn't get the gene, except we don't know what we're testing for, so we can't test you. So that's even a harder decision to make. You have no idea if you're at risk, and you have to make a decision about prophylactic surgery.
So in the, I guess go back to the conversation at the end. Let's suppose somebody comes in who it's clear should have testing. Right, you know, they're age 23. They have a family, right? They have a family history, but they're the only child. Right, so that's like your prime candidate for testing. And they walk in and they tell you, "I really don't want a beer, but my husband insists."
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to somebody walks in where, you know what, there's a lesser chance. So is the extent, right? Is the extent of the conversation you have different in that in the first case? You really just wanted to get the consent anyway, and so you're not going to risk the consent. You're just, right, you know, you'll talk to them because you're happier if they come in, if they end up happy about it, but you're not willing to take the chance because of really making them rethink because you really want them to be tested.
No, I mean, I would say 95% of the time, if someone walks through that door after the conversation, they've rethought it and they do want to get tested. But that 5% who don't want to get tested because this affects their own body as opposed to just being a carrier of something, I'm much less likely to push on this. So I will often say, like, why don't you think about it, talk it over with your family, here's a pamphlet, why don't we plan to see each other again a year from now and see how you're doing with this information. Because over time, like say that 23-year-old, she may not care that much for herself right now, but then when she has a baby, she might say, oh my God, I want to be here for my baby. I want my child to grow up with a mother. And she might change how she's thinking about it. So with the cancer susceptibility, because it's actually your own predisposition as opposed to, you know, being a carrier of something, which is less of an effect on your own health, I'm much less likely to push. I encourage and I give information, and I, you know, sometimes if I'm really worried, I'll call the referring physician and say, look, you know, you referred your patient. She's really high risk. When I put her in BRCA Pro, which is like a calculator giving you risk, she comes back at 78% risk, and she refused to have the test. So I think that it's worthwhile discussing with her just pursuing extra screening measures without doing the test for now and see how she comes along over her lifetime. But, you know, this is the kind of test that, you know, really the outcome is so life-changing in terms of what it means for you, that I really make sure that people fully consent.
That's a great answer.
In terms of one thing I think I haven't covered with this, which is back to what you were asking about insurance before. So with the BRCA information, this is very serious for life insurance. So say I have someone who comes and she's the daughter of, or maybe say her aunt had a BRCA gene. Okay, so her aunt has the BRCA gene. Her aunt was affected with breast cancer at 64, but she had multiple relatives above her, or her kids had breast cancer early. Somehow she got tested, but this person is now two people removed, so they have a 25% chance of being affected. They're in their mid-20s. They haven't had children yet. They don't have life insurance yet, and they come to me for screening. At that point, I usually say to them, I think you need to go get life insurance. And the life insurance situation is that when you go for life insurance, they you have to reveal your own medical records, right? So that could have your genetic testing results in it. You don't reveal your aunt's genetic testing results. You have to report your aunt's cancer history. So your aunt had cancer at 62. Okay, you know, the actuaries that figure out the life insurance aren't going to think much of breast cancer at 62. But if they happen to ask about your third cousin once removed who had ovarian cancer at 26, they would start figuring out and doing the math that you might have a BRCA mutation. But the, you know, really with life insurance, people usually want to seek the life insurance before they do the genetic testing for this, because if you have a BRCA mutation, your life insurance is probably going to be unattainable at that point. It's going to be so costly that you can't get it. If your mother had a BRCA mutation and you somehow can end up getting life insurance, then you get tested and you test negative, then you can just drop the life insurance because you'd be able to get it later with your negative BRCA results. Yep.
You, and you would recommend whole life insurance as opposed to term life insurance at that point?
I don't get into details. I just say, go speak to a life insurance salesman. And you would think I would know that because my father actually sells life insurance. But it's one of those like areas that I, you know, I'm not expert in. So I just say, like, you should go speak to someone about getting life insurance. And, you know, I had a very uncomfortable situation once where a man came in. He had had breast cancer. He was Jewish. He was in his 50s, and he came back positive for BRCA mutation, so he brought in his daughter, who was in her early 20s. And before, you know, I had spoken to him about bringing her in, and I explained that, you know, she might want to get life insurance before she comes to speak to us and, you know, see how that goes. If she can get life insurance now, that would be a good idea. And he said to me, don't worry about it, she's taken care of. So he essentially was being, you know, very paternalistic, as he is her father, saying that he would take care of whatever needs her children had, and he would be leaving money to her, and that we should not concern ourselves with life insurance. And he also asked me not to disclose any of the numbers. So he didn't want me to tell her what percent of people get ovarian cancer, what percent of people get breast cancer. He just wanted me to tell her that, you know, there was this risk of her having this gene and we should get her tested.
How old was she?
She was in her early 20s.
She's an adult. What right does he have to tell you what?
Right. Well, this is what parents feel they have the right to do. Is, you know, it doesn't matter how old.
It would be nothing to you.
What?
But it would be nothing to you.
Right. So, I mean, he tried to tell me all this, and I said to him, you know, with all due respect, sir, like, I need to discuss certain things with her, and, you know, we'll see how it goes. And but then, of course, he, like, came to the visit with her, so it was very difficult, and, you know, I essentially was saying she would have an increased risk. I had said to him, if she asks me the percents, I'm absolutely going to answer her. And she did end up asking me the percents, and I shared it with her. And I think I brought up the life insurance, and he interrupted and said, I've already spoken to her about it. So then I looked at her and said, like, have you spoken about it? Are you okay with not getting life insurance? And she said, yes. Which I still felt uncomfortable about, because, like, who knows, he's really going to leave money to her or not. I don't know. But, you know, it's uncomfortable when you're in a situation where parents are still acting as parents when the person is over 18 and they're in the room, but that person has consented to have their parent in the room, you know. So you can get into very sticky situations.
To what extent do you do, or maybe not you, but other of your colleagues do, like, follow-up counseling when people get their results? And also beyond just the specific medical advice, but...
Right. So our clinic policy is to always give results in person, and whether they're positive or negative. So we always say to the person, you know, your results will be available in 2 to 2.5 weeks. We'll see you at that point in time. We often suggest that you bring a family member or friend to help hear the results, because sometimes if it's positive, it's very overwhelming emotionally, and you may do better having someone to hear the information with you and to drive home with. So a lot of people do bring someone, and so we always make sure to give that result in person, and, you know, we sort of assess how they're feeling, and our genetic counselor does have, you know, background in sort of psychological counseling and stuff, so we usually give her card, and then also if they're positive, we're referring them to the breast health care center who does have somebody to speak to them also. So we always make sure that they know that there are resources available for emotional support, And you can sort of judge, I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a while, so you can sort of judge, like, ahead of time how people are going to take it, because we often ask them, like, how are you going to feel if this is positive, and if the person says, like, I'm going to kill myself, you don't go ahead with the testing right then. They first get some counseling. But if they've sort of thought about it and they've embraced it and say, you know, I think I'll feel much better knowing, and then I can empower myself, that's what you want to hear. But sometimes you hear things that make you concerned that they're not going to handle the information well. So I had one woman recently who, you know, when I said, what other medical problems do you have? She's like, I have chronic anxiety, I'm bipolar, and I have, you know, like she had multiple issues. And so first we discussed, like, at length how her medications were working for her. Was she feeling well controlled? When's the last time she thought of hurting herself? How often does she meet with her therapist? And so she usually meets with our therapist like Thursday afternoon, so I specifically scheduled an appointment like Thursday at 11 so that she could go from our appointment to her therapist for the results. Thankfully, she came back negative and didn't have to do that, but, I mean, didn't have to, you know, deal with those emotions. But we do try to be very careful because for things like, for instance, Huntington's disease, which is, you know, a fatal condition when it does come on, we don't actually do that testing at our center. We counsel about the option of Huntington's testing, and if someone wants to go through with it, we send them to BU where they have a six-person group that's like a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a social worker, a geneticist, a neurologist, who all see that patient to assess whether they're ready to hear that kind of information.
I don't know how it is here, and I don't know how it is in your experience, and I don't have any direct experience, but I know, so like, my mother-in-law had breast cancer, and then her sister didn't get it, but she did the surgery prophylactically. And so I guess like the new term is previvor because she went through all of this and did the surgery but never actually had the cancer. And I know just like through her that there's, you know, people who are interested in going to some of the same like support groups and things like that because they did go through this really difficult procedure. But there's sort of a stigma sometimes of like the people who have the cancer versus, you know, he or she never had cancer, and so they kind of resent her for feeling the need to have that emotional support, but she still feels like she lost her breast and her ovaries,
right.
And that was for her. And so, yeah, I don't know if that's something that you deal with at all, but I know that it's sort of hard sometimes for those people to find other places to get that support.
Right. So, I mean, because we usually send people to the breast health center from our center, I don't usually see the people after those sort of surgeries, but I would hope that, you know, over time they'll develop separate support groups to allow people to express themselves.
How are the consent protocols in your lab developed?
So, for most of the companies, they actually have their own consent protocol that comes, it's like, you know, a long form, and essentially, you know, the things that are mandated on these sort of forms are description of the condition, test sensitivity, meaning of a positive result, availability of diagnostic testing, to whom the result should be disclosed. So sometimes, so that's a big thing with genetics, is that the actual, like, report that has the information on it is usually, you know, sent to me, and I give a copy to the patient, but we try not to mail that around. So within a letter, it might say they came back positive for something, but the actual test results are sort of owned by the patient and the doctor, that you're only doing the DNA tests requested, so that we're not, when we're looking for breast and ovarian cancer genes, that we're not also looking for the Huntington's gene. People are often very nervous about that because they have a member of the family that has something else they don't want to know about, and they say, well, you're not testing for Huntington's, are you? Or you're not testing for Fragile X, are you? Because I don't want to know about that. And really, no company is going to perform extra tests for free that you didn't sign for. So, but you have to make that clear. Usually the forms have to indicate whether or not the DNA will be de-identified and used for further research. So many of the labs destroy the blood after 90 days, and other labs have a line in there that says, you know, we will de-identify your blood sample and utilize it for further research. And then, you know, the patient has to sign, and usually there's a space for a witness. So those are the rules of the game in most places. In New York, they actually have, like, even more laws about that. Like, New York has its own set of laws.
That's the form. But the whole conversation we just had is pre-form.
Right.
So where do you develop the whole...
So that is just sort of the medical ethics of genetic testing and consent. And that's, there's no real agreement, there's no form, this is sort of what one learns training in genetics or genetic counseling, that these are all the areas you need to address, and you do your best to address them and to reiterate them in a typed clinic note that goes out to the patient that's often like 3 or 4 pages long so they can refer to it afterwards. But there are no rules. And some of the hospitals disclose the results over the phone, which I find like completely horrifying, and they're very used to doing it and they're okay with it. So, you know, there aren't rules of the game that are in stone. It's really a development
in
over time.
In principle, it would be fine if someone just walked in, signed, and said, test me now, and you just said, okay.
I mean, I wouldn't feel good about it, but there's no legal problem with it. Unless they came back positive and then said, I didn't actually understand what I was testing for. Because, like I said, the consent forms, for whatever reason, do not hold up in court as consent. So, I mean, you know, it is the goal of every doctor to make sure that, well, I hope it is the goal of every doctor to make sure that their patient understands what they're being tested for, what the ramifications are for themselves and for their family members, and that they're given time to ask questions. And so as opposed to your regular doctor's appointment, which may be 15 or 20 minutes, our appointments are always like 60 to 80 minutes. And we spend a lot of time answering questions and saying, you know, can you repeat that back to me, or what did you understand from that, or, you know, just to make sure that they really understand what they're getting into.
And insurance company, how do you bill in that sense? So you bill for the test, but, you know, how do insurance companies deal with you taking 80 minutes per patient?
Right, so it's just called a level 5 consultation. It is like 80 minutes. And, I mean, I happen to usually bill at level 4, which is 60 minutes, because that's usually how long it takes. But sometimes it can take 80 minutes, and you just have to document that you spent, you know, 60 minutes in consultation with this patient, primarily doing counseling. And, I mean, I think the insurance companies have learned to appreciate that, you know, you can get into more trouble if people don't know what they're being tested for or being tested willy-nilly for things.
And why do you think genetic testing has, you know, has get the insurance companies supporting these long meetings, whereas almost any other medical condition? Nobody has any, you know, why is your regular doctor's visit just 20 minutes? And, as you know, and more immediately serious things can happen in that context.
That's a great question. So I guess because geneticists are felt to be, you know, subspecialists, there's certain amount of time designated. I mean, if you go to a pulmonologist for an initial evaluation, you also would have a, you know, 40 or 60 minute slot. So initial evaluations are usually longer, and then follow-up appointments are, you know, 15 or 30 minutes. So I guess the information that specialists are handling is usually felt to include more details and more level of discussion than some common problems.
Okay.
May not be equitable. But for that 60 minutes, we're getting paid a lot less than a neurosurgeon is getting paid for that 60 minutes. And probably, you know, at some point, obviously, everything has to be equalized and appropriate, because one problem is not necessarily more important than the other problem that the general physician sees.
Okay. I think I may have time. Thank you. That was terrific. That was good.
If anyone's interested, I just brought some of the pamphlets from our screening center for Jewish genetic diseases, and probably the most useful part for those of you who are not in Boston is my back line, which is in the middle on the back here. So if you ever yourself are interested in Jewish genetic screening for like Tay-Sachs and all that, or you know someone who's interested and they're having trouble with their insurance and stuff, they can always give a call, and I can try to give some advice in whatever area they live in to try to make sure that that happens. So I'll just leave these for you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much. Right on. All right.